This podcast edition of Midori House was first aired on the 30th of November 2011 for Monocle 24 here in London.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham, in London. In this hour, we'll meet a survivor of the longest-running battle in Africa, a Ugandan child soldier turned world ambassador for young people. He's in London today to be honored. And much to talk about with the latest edition of Monocle now on the newsstands, so with culture on his mind, Robert Bound will join me later. And finally, ever wish there were more hours in the day to get things done? Well, there's help at hand.
Ultimately, getting more done is important only if we're getting the right things done.
That's Midori House over the next 60 minutes. First, let's get the news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Britain shut down the Iranian embassy in London and expelled all its staff today, saying the storming of the British diplomatic mission in Tehran could not have taken place without some degree of consent from Iranian authorities. Foreign Secretary William Hague also said the British embassy in Tehran had been closed and all staff evacuated following the attack yesterday by a crowd that broke through gates, ransacked offices and burned British flags in a protest over sanctions imposed by Britain on the Tehran government. Germany said it had recalled its ambassador to Iran for consultations. Norway has closed its embassy in Tehran due to security concerns. And Italy is considering closing its embassy and will summon the Iranian ambassador to ask for guarantees for the safety of the country's diplomats. The top US military officer today rejected accusations by Pakistan's army that NATO's cross-border air attack that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers was a deliberate act of aggression. General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, "I can say categorically it was not a deliberate attack." A senior Pakistani army official said the attack was a deliberate, blatant act of aggression, hardening Pakistan's stance on the incident that could hurt efforts to stabilize Afghanistan. Pakistan's decision not to attend a conference on the future of Afghanistan in Germany next week is final, a foreign ministry official said today. Earlier, NATO's senior civilian representative in Kabul, Dominic Medley, said it was important that Pakistan was there.
It marks 10 years of looking back on Afghanistan. It looks at regional issues. It will show the continued international community support to Afghanistan in the interests of peace in this region. Very important conference.
Ivory Coast's former president Laurent Gbagbo will appear before the International Criminal Court within days to face charges of crimes against humanity, including murder and rape, the first former head of state to be tried by the ICC since its inception in 2002. Gbagbo was arrested and flown overnight from Ivory Coast to the Netherlands, where he was transferred to a detention centre in The Hague. US Vice President Joe Biden said today the US troop withdrawal from Iraq by the end of the year opened a new phase in relations between the two countries, including a robust security partnership. The remaining 13,000 US troops in Iraq are scheduled to leave by the end of the year. When a bilateral security pact expires nearly 9 years after the US invasion that ousted dictator Saddam Hussein. In a meeting between delegations from the US and Iraq, Biden said there was no chance that the withdrawal would miss its deadline.
We kept our promise to withdraw our troops from Iraq's cities in 2009. We kept our promise to end our combat mission in the summer of 2010. And now we are keeping our promise we made back in 2008 to remove our troops from Iraq by the end of this year.
Police in riot gear and biohazard suits removed anti-Wall Street activists from an encampment outside the Los Angeles City Hall today, arresting an estimated 200 people. Last night on the East Coast, about 100 protesters from the Occupy movement in Philadelphia swiftly and peacefully vacated their camp, but later 52 were arrested around the city on charges ranging from obstructing a highway to aggravated assault on a police officer.
At this point, you're given notice that you must vacate the North Plaza area. City Hall immediately. At the time you're free to leave, gather all of your possessions and leave immediately, and you will not be arrested.
And hundreds of thousands of teachers, nurses, and border guards protesting over pension reform staged Britain's first mass strike for more than 30 years today. in a confrontation with the government over its austerity measures. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
And I thank you for that, Nick Kelly. We'll have you back again.
Thank you.
Excellent. Now let's have a look at the global weather with Tomasz Szafranecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And it's getting windier and windier across some parts of Western Europe. Flights into airports like Heathrow, Oslo and Hamburg are getting bumpy. And as we head into early December, it might get even windier. The Mediterranean, on the other hand, is relatively quiet, sunny for the moment. By Friday, rain in Spain. Here's Thursday's city forecast. In London, 10 Celsius, rain at times. Milan, 6 degrees and cloudy. In Oslo, 8 Celsius, windy with rain. And in Athens, it's 17 Celsius and sunny. Air travel, and this is an extended outlook, keep an eye on the forecasts for the next 3 days. With a powerful jet stream, disruptive weather is always possible across western parts of Europe. North America now, and the eastern half of the US has been suffering from poor weather since Monday. By Thursday, the weather should be turning sunny again. In fact, sunshine all the way from southern Texas, across the Mississippi to St. Louis, and also all the way to New York State. Colorado and the Rockies, snow. On to Thursday's city forecast. Houston, 23 degrees and sunny. In Denver, minus 2 with snow. Chicago, 6 and sunny. In Washington, D.C., 10 Celsius and sunny. And a look at the Far East. China, fairly good weather in many major cities over the next few days. However, rain for South Korea and Japan. In fact, this weekend, awfully wet weather to come for Japan. Delays at airports are possible. Let's have a look at Thursday's city forecast. Shanghai, 12, partly cloudy. Hong Kong, 20 and sunny. Seoul, 7 degrees and cloudy. In Tokyo, 8 Celsius and rain. That's it. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranecker here on Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is now 7 minutes past the hour. In a moment, we're going to be hearing the story of Jonathan O'Queer, a former child soldier who's now speaking on behalf of and helping members of this lost generation.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, you're welcome.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The
Ruokajalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, it is said to be the longest-running armed conflict in Africa, and I'm referring to the Lord's Resistance Army, which was formed in 1987, and that's when it began a campaign of terror across Uganda and into neighboring countries. Killings, rape, and torture, all commonplace. Over the years, it is the children who have often captured our attention. Tens of thousands were forced to kill in the name of the Lord's Resistance Army. Jonathan O'Queer was one of those children. He was kidnapped at the age of 10, I believe, eventually made his escape, and he certainly managed to turn his life around. Well, Jonathan is with us in our studio now on a day of celebration. He's been honoured in London today. But we're also joined by Corin Verity, who is the founder of a rehab group for child soldiers, the World Youth Education Trust. So Corin's been with Jonathan all day today. But Jonathan, first, well, to you both, a big welcome.
Thank you.
And Jonathan, you are smiling. It looks to me like you have left that nightmare of killing and war quite far behind you.
Yeah.
Is it all gone?
All are gone.
How does it feel to be in London and to be meeting the Duke of Edinburgh and making a speech at St. James's Palace?
Really, I feel so excited because I've never been in the palace. But today I was so happy and excited to be in the palace because it was too nice for me.
Yeah. And the Duke was impressed with you?
Really, he was really impressed with me.
You're working to gather points to win his gold award. He gives award to people who do remarkable things.
Yeah.
Okay. Corin, I want to come to you, but just before, you were here today too. What, you heard the speech, you were in the palace.
Yeah.
What was this like for you, and what was it like?
You know, it's been a long journey since I met Jonathan 4 years ago. And when I met Jonathan, he was just digging and collecting charcoal to be able to raise enough money to look after his mum. To put Jonathan back through school and to see where he's come over these 4 years, but particularly through this last year where Jonathan's been working on the award, he's been an ambassador for our program. It's incredible. So today's speech at St. James's Palace was phenomenal. It's been a very proud moment for me.
Well, before we can, ask
how you've come to this occasion where you can smile and look to be a strong and confident person, I've got to ask you something about what you were put through. You spent a year, you were trained to kill. And in your speech, which I've quickly been able to read here, you asked the audience at St. James's Palace not to fear you, not to be afraid of you. Why did you have to tell them that?
You know, in most of the places that I went, even in our village, when we first came back to the bush, there was people that were talking about us, that we are bad people, we are rebel, we have been killing for some time ago. So people, even children, friends of ours, sometimes they used to fear us, they fear to even to play with us. So always, people always fear about us because what happened in the bush long time ago was really bad. And not all the people who are in the bush, they're bad, but they were forced to do those things.
Including you?
Yeah, including me, because I had no choice was to do those things, but they were forced me to do. And because you are told to do, you need to do it.
And we must spell it out. You were forced to kill civilians.
Yes, obviously. What I've done, because it's the way of survival. If you refuse to do, they will kill you instead of that fashion that you have refused to kill him or her. So it was a common thing to everybody. Once you are told to do anything, you need to do it.
How do you manage, and how have you managed to, I mean, in some sense, this is always going to be with you, but you've also managed to move on from that and make something of yourself. How have you been able to do that?
I was managed to escape because there was a big battle of war on the day when the helicopters, you know helicopters?
Helicopters?
Yeah, helicopter guns.
Gunships?
Yeah, and troops who were moving on down, and the helicopters moving on down. There was a big battle that the bombers, because we were moving on one battalion.
So you're talking about the moment you had the chance to get away?
Yeah, the chance to get away in the bush.
Okay, and that's an amazing moment, and for you, your liberation. But also I'm interested in how the psychological and social process you've been through, and maybe, Corin, you can help with this too, to put that terrible stage of your life behind you.
Yeah, it's very difficult for these youths because they come out of the bush and they receive very little support from their community. Their community fears them, which is exactly why Jonathan said what he did today. Quite often they're actually targeted by their community as seen as murderers. So these young people have to work on their own to try and find some form of reconciliation within their community, but within themselves. Jonathan... We find the number one way of doing that and handling that is self-esteem, and that occurs usually through education. When these young people can go back to school and when they can start to integrate with their peers of the same age, they find ways to be able to become sort of youths that weren't conflict affected, if you like. It's a long process, but they need to find leadership opportunities, and they need to find education opportunities, and that allows the community to see that they have value. And then once the community has reconciled with them and they're welcomed back into the community, they then get all of a sudden get a family again. But you know, for most of these kids, they killed their own parents. We have 50% of the children are forced at their point of abduction to behead their own parents. It's a horrific story. So they return to nothing.
In Jonathan's case, luckily you return to your family intact.
Yeah,
I understand.
Yeah, because if you come to your family with some other people from the bush, what they're doing, you need to do. Even if they're killing your brother or your mother, you have no voice to say anything. Sometimes if they knew that is your brother or your sister, they can give you the machetes to kill that mother of your sister. So the best way was not to tell them that this is my brother, this is my sister.
Yeah, Jonathan has a very close relationship with his family, so, and particularly with his mother. He even references it most of the time as his number one reason that he had to just continue to try to escape from the bush. But, you know, a lot of these kids, and the reason that they try to remove their families is to stop these children from trying to escape. If a child doesn't have family to return to, then they don't try and escape.
So you're lucky. You're out, you've got a family, and you're studying. You're getting your education.
Yeah, of course.
What are you going to be when you grow up? I mean, you're 19, you're pretty grown up now, but what do you want to do with your life?
Initially, what I was interested to do was to become a police. and again
become a police.
Yeah, but now I made my interest to become a leader in future. That's what I wanted to do.
Politics.
Yeah, politics.
Politics calls.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, in northern Uganda, they're whether it's a youth leader or a leader, I mean, I think there's certainly a market there for him to be able to fill, you know.
Joseph Kony, he's on the his team is on the way out. The army's on the way out.
Well,
do we think?
I personally wouldn't say yes, because it's been 30 years and nobody's been able to track him down. 30 years of international pressure and support for the Ugandan Defence Force, and we still haven't been able to. This recent deployment by
the Americans,
by Obama to put special forces in there, isn't also necessarily within the mind of the northern Ugandan people. They're trying to move towards a process of reconciliation. They know that if Konya is continued to be pursued by the military, there'll be collateral damage. There's still at least 5,000 children in the bush.
And Konya, thank you for correcting my
pronunciation. No, it's fine.
It's good. You have a film coming. Is it out or it's on the way?
No, it's coming. We just finished our last day of shooting today at the palace. So.
Yeah. What a finale that is.
Yeah.
So, and is it called Walk to Freedom or Freedom?
Road to Freedom Peak.
And Freedom Peak is Kilimanjaro.
Yeah, so Uhuru Peak is a very symbolic peak for all Africans as the highest peak in Africa. And it means Freedom Peak.
And you went there, Jonathan.
Yeah, I went there to the top.
And did that give you a fantastic feeling of freedom?
Yeah.
Great.
In fact, I think his words were, you know, for the first time in his life, he had found a sense of freedom. So it was...
Great. So you're going to run to the editing suite now and get this film out, and we'll all see it. Where?
Do we... April 2012, I'd say. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much
for
coming in to tell us just a little bit about your story.
Thank you.
And it's been great to meet you both.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Corin Verity, the filmmaker and the founder of this rehab organization. Fantastic. And Jonathan Okwuor, it's really delightful to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we are going to play a song, and this is All We Do for Love by Benny Sings.
Why is it hard to just get along? We try and we break our heads. In my heart, I forget about.
That was Benny Sings with All We Do for Love. And let's say that one was for Jonathan Okwuor. How nice it was to meet that young man. You are tuned to Midori House on Monocle 24. And we'll be back with more after this.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world. In London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo. Where you can find a full range of Monocle products, perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
Editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings, and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I am Nancy Durham. Let's go to Egypt now, or rather bring Egypt to us. The world, of course, is closely watching the country's first elections following the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. Egyptians came out in huge numbers to vote this week, but we mustn't expect a very quick result. There's a prolonged election process going on. It means we won't have a winner till next year, I think, the 13th of January. Miret Ibrahim is managing director of the English edition of the Egyptian website Youm7, that's Y-O-U-M-7, and she is with us now. Miret, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And there was a huge turnout. Just a week or two ago in the studio here, I was talking with Tim Sebastian, just back from Cairo, and he was talking about the politics in disarray, not a proper opposition. But people have come out, obviously, with a huge thirst to have their say.
Yeah, that's right. Well, as you know, also recently there has been like the second revolution of anger, because the youth have witnessed violence from the cops, and they couldn't accept it anymore. But the mass majority of the Egyptians were also like eager to go to vote and having the elections and everything. So everyone wants the better for the country. Everyone sees it from their own perspective.
So they turned out in great numbers, but we don't really know yet what the vote. Do we have an indication of which way the voting's going to go? You must have exit polls and things like that.
Well, we don't have exit polls yet.
Oh, lucky you. You have to wait.
Yeah. But the early indications were announced last night says that the Muslim Brotherhood Party, or the what they call the Freedom and Justice Party, are on the top. And like just lately before I come, one of the indications in percentage was that they have 45% of the vote.
The Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
And is that a surprise or not? Because they've sort of waxed and waned over the past months.
Well, actually, it is a surprise. And if they haven't got a majority, it was also a surprise. Because there was either two scenarios in Egypt. The first one was that the people on the streets know that they are just manipulating the people's minds using their religion, and they are just like any other political party. They are not different. They are just using the religion to say that we are different or we are talking in the name of God. So the first scenario was the people knows that and they will not vote for them. And the other scenario was, okay, let's go back to the Egyptian culture, that the Egyptian citizen is religious, okay? Or let's say, I don't want to say superficially religious, but when it comes to real life, the priority is not about just the religion. It's about the deeds and the people and the daily life and everything.
But living a good... Like as a good city, a good
exactly,
religious citizen.
Exactly. But if you ask an Egyptian, a Muslim Egyptian, to put, or even a Christian Egyptian, to put a list of their own priorities, they will put religion on the top. So there are two scenarios. Either they will just vote for the Muslim Brotherhood because of their religion comes first, or they will just figure out that, okay, those people are not what they're saying, and we have just to discover more about the other parties.
So in the complicated state of politics in Egypt right now, I guess it is a very good moment for the Muslim Brotherhood, because even though they may be like any other political party, at least the people can identify this religious thing and they go, okay, maybe this is a good way to go, perhaps. The clear selling point of the Muslim Brotherhood is that they are talking about religion. So just based on what you've told me, that maybe the thing that just makes them the most appealing or very appealing to a large number of people.
Yeah, and not actually just the Muslim Brotherhoods, but also we have now the Salafis.
Yes.
We have two parts. We cannot just say Islamists, it's just the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis.
And they've been out in the Costa coffee shops meeting with people, I hear.
Yeah, but those Salafi Costa group, they are more open-minded. Salafis are willing to get to know more people, are actually joining other parties. But there are the let's say the nouveau-riche of the politics, who are the like Nour Salafi party, and they are entering the political arena for the first time. During Mubarak era, sometimes a group of them was used against the Muslim Brotherhoods to say that, okay, no, we represent religion better. No, we do. And it was like a battle between them. But now they are trying to get in more coalition to get the people to vote for the religion.
So, okay, take us, we're going to have to march this ahead a little bit. You do have a very complicated electoral system. I gather it's a combination of proportional representation, first past the post. How are we going to unpack this story and get a result? How many votes are left to take place? What's the next step?
Okay, I'll tell you what. The election, and that's, I think, for the first time, is going into three stages. The SCAF, or the Military Council, and the interim minister said that they cannot secure all over Egypt during the elections in one day. So what they did is dividing the election into three stages, and each stage have about 9 or 8 governorates, and each governorate, of course, have a runoff round. So we had the first round, and then the second round will be, I think, from the first round of the second stage will be on 14th of December, and then the runoffs on 21st of December, and then the last and the third stage will be 3rd of January. The runoff will be on 10th. And the people have, in each of these governments, governorates has go to vote for first to choose one that is what we call independent, and one who is a worker or a farmer. And then the list system, which is new for the Egyptians, and some people don't even know what it means.
Oh, dear. Well, we hope that they can all figure out,
hopefully,
vote in some interesting, exciting, good politicians, and we can move the story forward.
Yeah,
thank you
so
much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you. We were just talking with Miret Ibrahim, Managing Director of the English edition of the Egyptian website YUM7.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Yorkson.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
In the next half hour, Robert Bound, our culture man, will be with us to give us a look inside the new edition of Monocle magazine. But first, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Nancy. Britain shut down the Iranian embassy in London and expelled all its staff today, saying the storming of the British diplomatic mission in Tehran could not have taken place without some degree of consent from Iranian authorities. The Muslim Brotherhood said today it was leading in the initial count of results from the first round of Egypt's parliamentary election, and one source in its party said it had secured 40% of votes cast for party lists. A senior Pakistani army official has said a NATO cross-border air attack that killed 24 soldiers was a deliberate, blatant act of aggression, hardening Pakistan's stance on an incident that could hurt efforts to stabilize Afghanistan. 7 Syrian soldiers were killed by army renegades and 6 civilians were shot dead today as regional pressure tightened on President Bashar al-Assad, with Turkey imposing tough economic sanctions on Damascus. Teachers, nurses and border guards protesting over pension reform staged Britain's first mass strike for more than 30 years today in a confrontation with the government over its austerity measures. US Vice President Joe Biden has said the US troop withdrawal from Iraq by the end of the year opened a new phase in relations between the two countries, including a robust security partnership. Ivory Coast's former president, Laurent Gbagbo, will appear before the International Criminal Court within days to face charges of crimes against humanity, including murder and rape, the first former head of state to be tried by the ICC since its inception in 2002. Police in riot gear and biohazard suits removed anti-Wall Street activists from an encampment outside the Los Angeles City Hall today, arresting an estimated 200 people. And Hillary Clinton became the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit Myanmar in more than 50 years, launching an historic mission to press the reclusive country's new leaders to sever illicit contacts with North Korea and deliver on reforms. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Well, we are still here in Midori House, and our show is called Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham, and I'm delighted to have with me for the next little while our culture editor, Robert Bound.
Hi, Nancy.
Bobby Bound.
Oh, God.
That just popped out of my brain somewhere.
Let's warm up this cold studio somehow.
Let's do it. It is very... Actually,
it's very chilly. Is this one of your choices? Or
no,
did you inherit the chill factor from someone else?
It was cold, so I made it hot. Then it was too hot, and I made it cold, and it's now just there. I know. I'll give you my jacket
or something like that. It's going to be fine.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah.
I've seen you upstairs working hard, reading, and you've got your
doing my other thing, which is doing lots of typing.
Typing really fast, and you really type
very loudly.
Loudly, yeah. And busily.
Just so everyone knows.
I wondered if you're just making it up, you know? No.
No, that's real life. If I shouldn't say it's typing, it's writing. It's not a typing pool, is it? It's more of a magazine, you might call it.
Oh, yeah, it's very magazine-y.
So, yeah.
Love the atmosphere up there. Exactly. It's very nice to be here. Nice to see you. And I'm looking forward to having a little walk through this.
All right, well, exactly. If there wasn't any hard typing and hard writing, there wouldn't be any December-January issue of Monocle. We've talked a lot about the soft power, the sort of first half of the magazine, but there's soft power that runs all the way through the magazine. And the lead story for the culture section in this particular issue is about Turkish soap operas, the export thereof. Soap operas are a huge... It's the fastest-growing exporter of drama series anywhere in the world. And these rather sort of dynastic sort of glossy and rather sort of beautiful and sexy drama series. They don't like to call them soaps, although to you and I, they're a little bit similar to soaps.
Might we? We're going to talk more about them in a little bit, but might we see them here? UK, Canada.
I think you could possibly, if you've got one of those, if you're with a digital or satellite provider that has many, many channels, you might find one. But I don't think they're ever going to make it to the UK.
Is it strictly Turkish? Is it Turkish language, or are they?
It's Turkish language, but mostly, and it's Turkish language, and then it'll be dubbed into Arabic because the Middle East is their largest exportee. Yeah. You know
okay,
what I mean.
You can have that one.
Yeah, I'll
go with that.
All right. So yes, it is mostly a Middle Eastern phenomenon, but then the sort of Muslim communities and in fact the communities in Eastern Europe as a whole also are buying into them big time in Romania and Bulgaria and these sorts of places.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And who knew? But you can read all about it in our magazine.
We did.
Excellent. So that's soap. What about music, books?
Oh, okay.
Movies.
So, well, yeah, I mean, the thing, what we also run in this thing is our big cultural diary, which covers books, films, music, what's the other thing, art, and you name it, all the other bits and bobs.
Do you want to tell us some faves?
I'm just going to, you can hear me flicking through it. Do you want to hear me do that?
It's nice paper, the quality of the paper sounds.
We'll have a bit of a flick.
Yeah.
Well, pop-wise, I think we're going to play one of her tracks. I'm not sure whether that's going to be now or later. But one of the things, and we, in fact, had a little profile of her. We interviewed and did a profile of her. It's Oland, who's a Danish pop star who's gone to New York to make her debut record. And our man Tom Hall, who works on this show, interviewed her very nicely.
Excellent.
So she's someone I'd tip. I think she's going to do lots of festivals next year. I think she's going to be a very busy girl. I think she's going to be omnipresent on TVs and radio stations around the world, not least of all ours.
And her name is O-O-H, Land.
O-H, Land. Oh, Land.
Oh, Land.
Exactly.
Oh, Land. Could you turn the heat up in here, for instance?
Precisely.
Okay.
That's some sort of, I think that's some contraction of her real Danish name.
Name. Okay.
Did I say Norwegian? I meant Danish, sorry, when we were talking about it earlier.
I was too chilly. I didn't
know.
She's
Danish. I'm looking through the glass.
They're not helping us.
They're not helping
Danish?
Us. She's just chewing gum or something back there. I think she's Danish. So so that's a cool thing. And then there are lots of other things that came in this package from Denmark as well, which were bands like Darkness Falls and the late Greta Fitzcarraldo's, which I think I've played already when I've been manning the desk on this show, in fact.
Great.
So that's that. And then all sorts of other things. There was something we wanted to bring to people's some people's attention was the Guadalajara International Book Festival. Sounds a bit... sounds self-consciously international, but it's not. I think it's very cool. It's kind of like a great meeting of minds of all the Latin American novelists and publishers and the book market in Latin America, which is booming and is going to become more and more translated.
Has it happened?
It's on now.
Right now it's on.
It's on now until the 4th of December. So you've still got to... If you're thinking of catching a plane to Mexico, you might want to drop by there.
Is it like, dare I ask, the Hay Festival? Is it along those lines?
I think it is. So it's a bit... There's lots of tents of things going on, but I think it's more of a businessy thing. I think it's more like the Frankfurt Book Fair rather than being literary, it's salesy.
Introduce your book, get publishers
from
around the world.
Exactly. If you were an author, you might have a sort of a one-to-one scale cardboard cutout of yourself looking kind of astute and cerebral.
So glad I'm not an author.
Well, it's all right.
Well, I actually am an author, but not now.
Okay.
Not at this moment.
Not now.
I'm the author of one book. Okay.
All right.
Okay, exciting.
So, there are some things, anyway.
Exhibitions, film festivals.
What have we got? Film festivals. Yeah, as I say, well, it sort of gets a little bit quieter. Obviously, Sundance is coming out. That's the big one in January. So that'll be for most people the place to go. Again, it's great if you're in that neck of the woods, if you're in the Utah region.
Yes.
It's great saying that, isn't it? It's great being international. Mm-hmm.
I know, and we're
hello out
there.
If you're in the Utah region, and you get your SUV, fill it up with a few sleeping bags because you could never find a hotel room worth your money.
And to all our Utah listeners.
Exactly. And get out there, which is good. We had a good time there. I made a film there last year.
Great.
Which was very cool.
Which one was that?
It wasn't cool. I didn't make an actual feature film and show it there, but I made a film about people making films.
Nice.
It's on the website, monocle.com.
Okay.
You could check it out if you want to be a year late and what's happening in
what's
films.
What's it called?
I can't remember the name of the film.
Sorry.
But it's nice. It's one of those heartening things. You think you're doing vaguely something right when you see billboards in the underground in London for films that are kind of coming out now in London, which you saw a year ago.
Oh, that's great.
So you think maybe I've interviewed the right people if they're kind of popping.
Excellent.
Up.
Is there one you want to name, or am
I don't know what's
spot?
Happening. I saw Another Earth, which is out now in London and across Europe, which is a debut feature, and I can't remember the name of the director, but it's a very cool thing indeed.
It's a
bit like Lars von Trier's Melancholia, which is out in the summer here in Europe.
I just saw it.
And it's a bit like that, but a bit less taking itself seriously. It's rather more beautiful than it is disturbing.
Okay.
So it's about heavenly bodies.
Mm.
I'm talking about the lead actress, obviously, now, so you can tell.
Do you know who she is? You can't think of who she is.
I can't think who she is. Yes. It's her face on the poster, anyway.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah. So there's some things.
Some lovely
I can
things.
Name some books. I can do all sorts of things.
I'd love...
If you want me to run, I can run.
I'm actually thinking of buying. What
Well,
what
actually, a book I'd like to plug, which I think is in this guide, and we had him on a couple of weeks ago, is Vanished Kingdoms, which is the historian Norman Davies's huge tome, but very digestible tome, on all the parts of Europe that were republics, empires, and kingdoms, and all the rest of it, that have sort of vanished and fallen by the wayside. And it's particularly interesting in the light of what's happening in Europe at the moment.
Great.
Whether or not these certain places might fall off the map, certain places might be absorbed into other places, and all the countries you now think of unified, powerful, and solid might sort of drift
fracture
away.
Into these little bits.
Like castles in the sand, Nancy.
Or islands in the stream.
Or islands in the stream.
Which is...
Is this a Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers duet you want?
Tyler and I, it's our song.
Okay.
Yeah, Islands in the Stream. Okay, would you recommend a novel? A good read? A thriller, perhaps?
What would I read? I've got to... Can you hear me flicking through the pages here?
That's fine.
It's been a while. I think...
Give people time to get their pens out so they can make a note.
Yes, exactly.
Recommendations.
Well, Haruki Murakami's new novel, IQ84, or 1Q84, has sort of split the critics. Our man thought it was very good. He thought he waded through 1,500 pages of this novel to give us a 70-word review of it.
Oh, dear.
Yes, indeed. But I think he felt it was worth it. I think he feels that you have to sort of go with it in order for it to be a classic. But I think that will be in a lot of Christmas stockings this year anyway.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Weighing down many a Christmas tree.
Thank you very much. Now, you're not leaving, but I have the jolly duty of introducing a song which you have chosen.
Oh, okay.
You reviewed. You just mentioned O Land, and the song is called Voodoo.
And the record is called O Land.
It's
what you might call an eponymous album, I think.
Oh, okay. All right.
O Land singing Voodoo from the album O Land.
Okay. O Land. Voodoo by O Land, on an album called O Land, selected for us by O Land, Robert Bound.
Thanks for that, Nancy. That's good stuff there.
Thank you very much. And you are listening to me, Nancy Durham, with Robert Bound on Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's very good to have you with us here, Robert, and we're talking about the current edition of the magazine.
Mm.
And the lead in the culture section is about soap operas in Turkey. You say they don't call them soap operas, but we would, or Turkish dramatic series, drama series, as they're referred to locally. And Monocle reports, I'm reading in this story, that Turkey is now the fastest growing drama series exporter in the world. O Land.
Would you believe it?
No.
Exactly.
Why do you think that is?
These kids, well, I think it's one of those things. It's a changing country, and it's a country that's getting wealthier, and it's television viewers are reflecting the sort of changing tastes in that country. So.
And to find out more about it, we do have our photographer.
Oh, okay, yeah, and I think we've got Matthew Pele on the line. Matthew, hi.
Hi.
How's it going? We've kind of cut our story in half here. Melissa Elfan wrote the story and you shot it. Now I wanted to know, first of all, when you got the commission from our photo desk, did you think you're a Frenchman that's lived in Istanbul for a year or so, I think. Did you think, oh wow, I understand this. I've seen this stuff on the TV the whole time. I kind of want to get my lens dirty on some of this soap opera.
Well, I had smelled it a couple of weeks ahead. There's definitely a hype going around with the importance of soap operas, and you know everybody's obsessed with them. And certainly they became very important geopolitically for the country to reflect positively on the whole region in the Middle East. In Eastern Europe, and even I found out when I did the story in Africa, where they are dubbed in French and widely distributed over many countries in Africa, which really surprised me. I looked at a map and production place where there were pins on where all the places where they have sold the soap operas, and even in some weird little islands in the middle of the Pacific, they managed to sell these Turkish soap operas. Oh, sorry, dramas, right? Yes.
Yeah,
sorry.
Come on, get it right, man.
I know.
and as a photographer, I mean, what appeals to you about a story like this? I mean, the shots in the magazine look amazing, but there's a proper visual richness, and there's a sort of Middle Eastern or Levantine kind of richness to the way that these things look, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, that's definitely something that attracts me. I've been photographing in Asia for over 10 years, and I'm definitely have a taste for these kind of colors, and I get attracted to them. But also, there's also that kitschy aspect that I really like very much to be thrown in the middle of. And certainly with the series, also the one I shot is a stage in the 60s, 70s. So you get this crazy, color combination. And
costumes and interiors.
Of course all the, an exaggerated expression on the actors because, you know, it's a drama. So that makes for a good picture opportunity. So I was very excited, of course.
Hey, Matthew, it's Nancy Durham here with Rob. And I'm looking at your photographs. They're lovely, lovely color, lovely poses, and I see the 60s, and I hope you won't kill me for asking, but is there kind of a Mad Men derivative thing here going on? Because it does look such a period piece.
Right, yeah, that could be. I don't know. I think it's older than Mad Men. I don't know when it was shot, Mad Men. I'm not sure. But, it's maybe something that is popular these days to shoot in this kind of epoch, in this kind of period.
The velour easy chairs and the girls in miniskirts and things.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, nice pictures, Rob.
And
thank you.
And when you went on set, I mean, what are the sets like? Because we call them sets, but they're actually real houses in real streets, aren't they? And there's a thriving sort of tourism industry in Istanbul from people from all over the Middle East to come and visit and go on these tours. Is the sort of difference between the set or the house on the street that it's shot in and the rest of the street very different? Is it glammed up and kind of showy for the show?
Well, they used to shoot it last year in an area of Istanbul called Fenerbahçe, which is quite more or less in the center. And Istanbul has a huge problem. The main problem with Istanbul is traffic jams. It's very difficult to get around the city if you choose, don't pick your hour properly. And so the filming was becoming more and more difficult to shoot out in that area. And so six months ago, I think over summer, they built, basically duplicated this area of downtown Istanbul to an area not far from where I live on the outskirts, where they are shooting now, And so they've recreated. So it's fake, but you know, copied what they were shooting on previously, the other sets that they had downtown. So yeah, it's been created over 2 months. I think they built this whole set, the streets, the houses, all this, you know, the everything. And there's one area which is offsite, which is near the Black Sea. It's about half an hour drive, where there's an incredible view, and some of the images are also from that set. So in a day, I went, you know, in that area not far from my house, and then we drove half an hour to that a lonely house on a cliff overlooking the Black Sea.
Cool. Well, I'm glad we managed to get you to the front of the queue on the Istanbul soap opera tour guide, Matthew. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Have a nice evening. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Matthew Paley, our photographer in Istanbul. Nice pictures, really good story too, and Robert Bound with me here. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Nancy, for giving the opportunity to plug my section.
I do look forward to future plugs.
That'll be all right.
And now we're going to have this.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
If you've ever found your workload slightly overwhelming, either at home or at the office or maybe both, and your to-do list seems to grow ever longer, well, you're not alone. Hundreds of busy people are taking a break for some 8 hours today to attend a conference in London called Getting Things Done. The idea was conceived in the States, but workshops are now held worldwide to help people who move fast go even faster. Just what we need. Todd Brown is one of the organizers, and he talked with Hugo McDonald and Amy Gutman about how to get a grip on our overflowing inboxes and weighty workloads.
If people are so busy, how can they take an entire day off to attend this?
It's a great question. And frankly, any seminar that focuses on personal productivity that isn't a good return on your time is a waste of time. So it's a question that we are very careful that people can answer positively. I suppose at the end of the day, what we're looking at is how do we help people get things done, get more done in sustainable ways. So they will change the way that they work. They'll change the way that they think about their work. And what that'll mean is that after today, they'll be moving even faster than they are.
Todd, you picked up on that a little bit there, but is it a state of mind that we need to be sorting out? I mean, how many people that you come across actually have physically too much to do that they can't get it done?
I think it's a great point. You know, so many people think productivity at the end of the day is the end goal. It's not really. What we're about is, yes, getting more done, but we're trying to do that in ways that help people to maintain clear mental space, because ultimately getting more done is important only if we're getting the right things done. And if we're in a state, in a mental state where our mind is cluttered with the you know, hundreds and thousands of things that we could be doing, we're not getting the kind of perspective that we need to make long-term decisions that are really the right decisions.
So how do you do that if you have competing deadlines for things? So, I mean, obviously, most people know that it's a case of prioritizing, but let's say you've got three deadlines to contend with, all of which are very important. How do you clear your head of all this pressure so that you can hone in on one of them and start getting things done?
Well, I think you've just said it. One of the great things that people can do is get things off of their minds. And a very practical thing that we coach people to do is literally sit down with some paper and write down absolutely everything that's on your mind. Everything. Big, small, personal, professional. I need cat food. I want to move to Spain. Anything that they've got in their minds. That all by itself creates a bit of clear mental space, okay? But what that also will help you to do is to generate the psychological state to be able to make better choices, make better prioritization choices about what you focus your time on.
So we asked a few people we know to contribute questions, burning questions about how to manage their time better and how to move faster. And I want to throw a few at you. What about when you're working to a daily deadline, but you still need to manage longer term planning? How do you juggle all of that?
Yeah. I think for most people, part of the problem is that daily life is so full of distractions for us. It's so easy to be, you know, what we call interrupt driven. That is driven by what's arriving, right? Sometimes I talk to people, I'll run a seminar and I'll say, okay, hands up. Everyone in the room who's ever spent a day, the entire day, just reacting to email. And, you know, more than half in most cases will go up.
It's such a time killer.
It is. And then another great question is, okay, at the end of that day that you were just responding to email, did you have a sense of genuine satisfaction that you'd achieved a lot and you'd focused on the right things? Probably not. And the reason is because in that instance, what you've done is you've focused on the urgent. It was just the stuff that arrived most recently. We say being driven by latest and loudest. It's what an awful lot of people spend their day doing. So the cure for that is, let's be clear, not just what's dropping into my inbox, because that's easy. I can see that. Let's also be clear, what am I trying to make happen, let's say a year from now, 3 to 5 years from now. Let's just be clear on those things. Not that I need to look at my, you know, strategic long-term goals every time I pick up the phone. But if I'm aware of those things, there's a better chance that I'll make good choices day to day about where to focus my time. In other words, I'll make more time for the things that will move my strategic goals forward.
Can I pick up on that? Because it's not too dissimilar from something that keeps me awake at night at the moment. It's so pathetic. But I have 9 nephews and nieces who are all between the age of 10 and 1. And it just panics me that I have to do their Christmas shopping before the end of next week. Trying to think what to buy, where to go, how to figure time in to actually go and buy it even, and then send it is probably the most Herculean thing I've had to do all year. Can you do it for me?
That's what personal shoppers are for.
No, what I really wanted to pinpoint is the fact that this is seemingly quite a small and very inconsequential anxiety, and yet it's something that has really built up in my mind. I'm so much better at dealing with the day-to-day and dealing with, you know, the endless inbox and things, but throw something like that into my week and it just, I'm not.
Well, okay, so let's see if we can get you moving on it so that it doesn't get to the point where it's now the 23rd or the 24th.
Exactly.
and you're down to the, you know, to the shops that are still open. Okay, so one very practical thing, just hearing you describe it, one of the things that I'm wondering is whether you're looking at it as this monolithic, huge thing that needs doing, right?
Yeah, so I am.
Okay, well, one thing you might want to consider is, let's break that down. They're 9 individuals, right? I'm assuming you can't buy the same thing for each one. Is that fair?
If only.
Exactly. Life would be much easier if I could, but no, sadly I can't.
So one thing I'd say is, let's break it down and let's make each one a manageable chunk. Now, the other thing, and another very practical thing you can do, is identify for each one of those, for each one of your nieces and nephews, what is the very next action that you're going to take to move that forward?
I want to just ask you, do you think a lot of the problems we have in getting things done nowadays is really a root, I guess the root cause could be called the internet, because it's so easy to just, you know, go and fact find something. Something pops into your head, or, you know, this interruption factor that you talk about, where you just waste so much time surfing the net. It could be on legitimate things, but things that really divert your attention from the tasks at hand.
I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, distraction on the internet is so rife, and it's so easy to click on a link. And if you're at all either someone who's, you know, sort of I call myself a bright bauble baby. So what that means, if something visual, interesting, you know, comes into my field of vision, I'm off. I'm there.
Thank you to Todd Brown, organizer of the Getting Things Done conference. Well, this brings us to the end of this edition of Midori House, and it's time to thank our producer today, Constance Chang, and our researcher, Tom Hall, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Well, Nick Kelly is going to be here with the headlines in just a moment. Then it's time for Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. I'm Nancy Durham, and I want to thank you for joining me on Midori House this past hour. It's 1 minute to the hour.